For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
John 1 really laid a theological groundwork for this book, and I thought Lee Campbell did an excellent job of putting that forth. And as we come into chapter 2, we see a couple of acts in Jesus' life that lay a foundation for his ministry. And he's going to deal with two really important questions. When it comes to approaching God, how do you approach God? And what he's taking a stand against here is kind of a ritualistic approach to God. He's throwing out the ritualistic approach to God. And then he's also dealing with the question of where do you encounter God? Because in this era and in history of people dealing with their spiritual life, they've focused a lot on a place, a sacred space. I go to this place and this is where I meet God. So right here, when Jesus launches into his ministry, he's going to deal with how do I approach God and where do I approach God. He starts off in at the beginning at an event in Cana, but I wanted to just the purpose of the book of John, this is important. Sorry, I sort of missed this. Where have we found so many times the answer to what is the purpose of a paragraph, for example? Was it at the beginning? Usually at the end, wasn't it? That's the way they sort of organize it. Here's the punchline, and a lot of times it comes at the end. Well, we go almost all the way to the end of the book of John, and he lays out explicitly what the purpose of this book is. He says, "But these things are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing in him, you will have life by the power of his name." He says, that is the purpose of this book. And so he's laying the foundation in these early chapters to drive to this point, so that by hearing these things, you may believe, that it'll change your perspective on who God is and how you're related to him, and that that will have an effect in your life. And what is it? That you will have life. And the word that's translated life is the word zoe, which means like spiritual life. It's more than the heart beating of a life. It's spiritual life, that you may have that by the power of his name. So that's where John's heading in this book. So let's read through John chapter 2, verses 1 through 12. It says here, "The next day there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities. So Jesus' mother told him, 'They have no more wine.' 'Dear woman, that's not our problem,' Jesus replied." Very compassionate, Jesus sounds like here, huh? "It's not my problem, lady. My time is not yet come." But his mother told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Standing nearby were 6 stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." When the jars had been filled, he said, "Now dip some out, take it to the master of ceremonies." So the servants followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. "A host always serves the best wine first," he said. "Then when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine." Sounds like a good strategy. "But you have kept the best until now." This miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. After the wedding, he went to Capernaum for a few days, and his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. Wow. So there's a lot going on in this passage, in this miraculous sign that Jesus did. Where did it happen? Well, it happened in northern Israel. You see Jerusalem here on the south, and there's the Dead Sea, this large lake at the bottom, and the Sea of Galilee up in the north. And Galilee is in the northern reaches, what they would even consider the rural areas of this region. And Cana is right up in there. And the problem they had in Cana was that there was a wedding going on, and we think of a wedding reception maybe a couple hours. Their wedding celebration might last a week. And wine was a very important part of this celebration. In fact, from some of the commentators I read on this, that if you ran out of wine, this was a major social faux pas. You know, just imagine something that would be really bad to do at a party. You fill in the blank in your mind. I can think of some things I wouldn't want to do or want done at a party. This is one thing you would not want to do, is run out of wine, because it's a betrayal of your guests. It's something that a couple might have to live down the rest of their lives. And so what happens? Well, Mary brings this problem to Jesus. Apparently she was involved with the celebration. I don't know if it was a family or a friend, exactly what, but you know, they're starting to pour and the vessels are empty. We're running out of wine, and somehow Mary, I don't know if she was serving or how she knew, but she knew. And then she comes to Jesus, and in our translation here it says, Jesus' mother told him they have no more wine. Dear woman, that's not our problem, Jesus replied. My time has not yet come. And you sit here and you think, well, I thought Jesus was supposed to be a nice man. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say? Why is he being such a jerk to his mom? You know, in the other translations, it sounds even rougher. In the new NIV, he just says, woman, why do you involve me? In the New American Standard, he says, woman, what does that have to do with us? And this is the newer, this is the NASB from 1995. I've got an old NASB, and it just said, woman, what do I have to do with you? And what's it show us? When there are this many different translations of a phrase, you know, the New Testament's written in Greek, right? When there are this many different translations of a simple phrase like that, it means it's really hard to translate. And it is. Literally, it says, what to me and to you? That is the literal word-for-word translation of what Jesus said. And when he said, woman, it wasn't like, hey, woman. It was like, ma'am, dear woman. It's a term of endearment, a term of respect. So it wasn't like he was putting her off when he said woman. So he says, ma'am. There's something significant in that, though. And I think what this is marking, it marks the beginning of this ministry of Jesus, where he goes out to the people, and part of that is performing miracles, but his relationship to his mother changes too. He didn't say mother, he said woman. That now he says, you are the same as other people in relationship to me. I mean, Mary knew from the beginning that this wasn't just a normal kid, right? Because this angel came to her and said, this will be Emmanuel. You are going to bear the Messiah. She knew that her and Joseph hadn't had sex to have this kid. I mean, there's something special about this kid. And when all these things happened, it says that Mary treasured them in her heart. You know, she knew there was something different about it. Who knows what he had done up to this point? But it seems like there was some expectation that when she saw this big problem, who did she bring it to? Well, she brought it to Jesus, with an expectation that he could deal with it. But this response, what to me and to you, what is Jesus really getting at here? And I think what it comes down to is he's talking about the relationship between her and him. The best way that I could put it that makes the most sense is he says, I'll handle this my way. What is to me and to you, not your way. And he doesn't say it out of disrespect. He says it out of an understanding of what is best for the situation. That's exactly what's going on here. She brings a problem to him, and maybe she had an idea that, because there are a lot of ways that Jesus could have answered this problem. He had them fill these stone water pots, they dipped it out, they've got plenty of, that's a lot of wine, you know? Hundreds of gallons. Plenty to last. Jesus could have done this other ways. And maybe Mary had something in mind that he would say, hey, hold up your cup and it'll be full. It'll never run out. That would be sweet. And it would bring glory to him, right? But what does he say? Here's the key to understanding this. Right here. He says, my time has not yet come. And my time, literally it says my hour. The time for me to my glory to be revealed to the masses has not yet come. So what Jesus does, he says, I'll handle this my way. His way was the quiet way. The only people that knew about what was going on were the disciples and the servants. The people just knew that the problem was solved. They might have not even, the people that were attending probably didn't even know there was a problem. The head waiter didn't know. They brought him this wine and he's like, man, this stuff's awesome. Why didn't you bring it out before, you idiot? So Jesus says, I'll deal with this my way. And then look at Mary's response. Verse 5, she says, but his mother told the servants, do whatever he tells you. What's this show you about Mary? Maybe she had an idea in her mind how the problem should be solved. But what she did is she took her problem to the person who could solve it. She knew he could solve it. And then she said, I will trust your judgment on this. She says to the servants, you listen to him, you do what he tells you. She says, I'm not going to tell him what to do because I trust that he will do what is right and he will do what is good. You see, I think that this is a paradigm, folks, for the kind of faith that we could emulate. Because a lot of times there are problems that we have, there are issues that we sense like, God should deal with this. And we all have something like that going on, maybe multiple things in our lives, things that we just can't answer. We look at the future and maybe it's somebody that we love and we see where they're headed and we wish that we could change it and we wish that God would change it. And we don't know how it's going to happen, but we just think and believe that something should happen. And those of us who want to control things, we try to manipulate and we try to push it a certain direction and we try to demand that God solve it the way that we think would be the best way. And if he doesn't, we get disappointed in him. And you see, that's not what Mary did. Mary said, we have a problem. It's substantial. It's going to lead to a lot of embarrassment and despair for these people. And she might have had an idea in her mind how Jesus could have dealt with this. And yet she put it in his hands and said, you take it. You take the ball. You run with it. And I think that's what God's calling us to do. Whatever that is in you that is tearing you up, that you just can't figure, you say, okay, God, I'm going to put this in your hands and I'm going to trust that you're going to deal with it. And you know what she did? I can just imagine the scene. She said, you deal with it. And she walked away and she did her thing. But her heart was at peace. You see? Because she'd put it in his hands. And that's what a lot of us need is peace in our heart, man. The anxiety, the turmoil, the angst when we look at the problems that need solved. And wouldn't it be sweet to be like Mary where you can take this problem, you say, do whatever he says, and you walk away and go about your business. That's what we have the prospect to do because of who we're dealing with. And the effect that this great sign had, we see in verse 11, it says, this miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory and his disciples believed in him. You know, this tells us a lot about what's happening here because he could have played to the masses. You know, he could have made sure everyone knew and that the people bowed down and worshiped him. And at certain points, he does play to the masses. Because he wants the masses to understand who he is. But in this case, he's laying the foundation. And the most important foundation for Jesus to lay is not to the masses. He knew how fickle they were. These same masses that welcomed him into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and said, Hosanna, this is the Messiah. What? They were the same ones that turned to him a few days later and said, crucify him, give us Barabbas. He knew how fickle the crowds were. But what he built into were his disciples. You see, that's it. His disciples believed in him. That Jesus' strategy Of course, he wanted the world to know about him, but he knew that the way to the world was through the few. The few committed disciples that he would take under his wing, that he would love, that he would teach, because he was face to face with them day by day. Those are the ones that would change the world. You see, and that's what he told his disciples. He says, go into the world and make disciples and baptize them. And you see, I think that's the model that the church followed. It's the model the Apostle Paul followed, and it's the model that he gives us to follow. It's one person communicating themselves and what they've learned, what God has taught them, the spiritual impact he's had on my life, that I can communicate that to another person. That's what lasts. And then that person takes it to someone else. You know, where we just have this big mess. I mean, if this is all we had, we wouldn't have it, because you'd all be gone. It would be totally lame if this was it. And if this is all you have in your spiritual life, it's not what God meant it to be. He meant it to be more. Where there's growing relationship, where we give and receive the love of Christ, it's iron sharpening iron, where we grow together like that. That's what has a long-term impact. I mean, if you don't believe me, just read the Bible and you decide what Jesus' strategy was. This was it. It was discipleship. And if there's one thing that I want to be able to look back, and I want to be able to look back at people that I have done my best by God's power and through his leading to communicate something of what he's taught me to them. That's discipleship. That's love. And that lasts. Okay, so that's what he's doing. He's laying the groundwork for his future strategy here. And then if we think of the significance of this act, first of all, it was an awesome provision, right? The amount, a lot of wine, the timing, impeccable. Right when they needed it. You know, that's the way God works. A lot of times he's not going to bring it too early or too late, right at the right time. That's what's so hard for us to believe. So hard for us to have peace when we put it in his hands. Will he come through? Yes, he will. When? When the time's right. I think, I want it now. What's the answer? Now's not the best time. Later's the best time. Why? Because he says. Well, why does he say? Well, because he's God, you know? He's God and you're not. I'm not. But I demand. I want it now. Well, he wants us to grow up and stop whining and demanding. So it's a lot. There's good timing. And what else? It's really good. It's the best. The best possible provision. That's what he wants to give. That's what's so hard to trust. So that's one important point here. But the symbolism also carries a lot of weight. It says that they took 6 stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. So they had these jars. They made them of stone because they looked at a ceramic vessel as being like porous. This would keep the sin out, so to speak. Because what they did is they took these stone jars, they filled them with water. Then they used the water to cleanse their hands. And this was not hygienic. This was before Pasteur and Lister, right? They didn't even have a germ theory of disease. This was ceremonial in the sense that they thought that because they had touched things that were religiously unclean, or they had been places where there were unclean people or unclean things, that made them. And if they had an unclean hand and I touch my food and I take it into my body, what's that do to my body? Well, my body is spiritually unclean by what I've taken in. And this is not biblical, even at that time. You know why? Because there were washings prescribed. Spiritual washings that meant to be a symbol, and they were for the high priest. And he was to wash himself. He was to wear this like clean linen underwear and all this kind of stuff, you know. And it all had a very important symbolic meaning, was that you come into God's presence cleansed. And you come with a sacrifice. Okay? But what they did is they took this ritual meant to teach, and they brought it into their day-to-day life. And what it ended up doing is it just backfired. Because what does it do? It gives the people the idea that my spiritual problem is coming to me because of the food that I eat or the things that I touch. And the way that I get rid of this is this ritualistic cleansing. And if I go through this ritual, it's going to change me. And what's Jesus say? Well, if you read through him, he says, dude, listen, you don't cleanse the outside of the cup. The problem with the cup is the dirt on the inside. It's your heart. It's your heart that is the origin of sin. It's your heart that is the origin of good. Clean the inside. The outside will become clean. That's what Jesus says. And you know what? He's laying the groundwork for that right here. He takes this water and he said, I think what's really cool is he said, fill them up to the brim. And he changed it all. How many water pots did they have left for ceremonial cleansing? Not one. Not one drop of ceremonial water was left. They couldn't even do it if they wanted to. They drip it. Oh, this is that good wine. I'll take a drink. None left for ceremonial cleansing. Man, this is really important, because what he's saying is that spirituality is internal, not external. It's internal, not external. It's not about going through an external practice. You know, and I think this can be confusing for a lot of people. Because, and I'm not saying rituals in themselves are necessarily wrong or bad. What I'm saying is, in the human mind and in the human just sort of psyche, that it's very easy to get into certain habits. And we get into habits in such a way that they become meaningless. You know, Jesus even said to the disciples, he says, when you pray, this is in Matthew 6, he says, when you pray, don't pray with meaningless repetition as the Gentiles do. Don't just repeat a memorized prayer in the sense that that is somehow going to appease God. You know, and they had chants. You go to a lot of religions of the world and you hear chants, you hear rituals, you have incense burning and all these things with the idea this external thing that I do, that is going to change my relationship with God. And Jesus he's just totally casting that to the side with this act. He says, no, it's not external, it's internal. It's an internal change, because this wine that they had been changed from the water, what did they use the water for? External cleansing. What's the wine do? You drink it in. It's an internal. And wine was the symbol of joy, of peace, of fellowship. What a difference. And you see, that's the prospect that we have in our relationship with God. A lot of us growing up in America, we've gone through a lot of rituals. Me, for one, it was sort of confusing for me because I got sort of tired of it. And as a child, even getting to the point where I thought, this is meaningless. It doesn't mean anything to me. I even remember as a little kid having the bulletin and checking things off as we went through, you know, just kind of hoping it would be over sooner rather than later. And I think that's the danger. I think some people, rituals can help them kind of remember and refocus. For a lot of us, it's had kind of an opposite effect. And it's not so much that I want to speak against that, because I think we have a variety of experiences, but what I want to speak for is this reality, that God's intent is to live in you, to be with you, to have a personal relationship with you, a relationship that changes you as you grow with him. And there's a starting point. Like any relationship, there's a starting point for that. That's what you got to understand. The starting point is being forgiven by him, because the Bible says there's a problem that we have when we approach an almighty creator God, and that is what the Bible calls sin. But the sweet thing about it is we're all in the same playing field here, man. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So all of us need to be forgiven. And God offers forgiveness to every person. And forgiveness is where this relationship begins. Because you're fundamentally different than him. You're unrighteous because of your sin. But you can have the righteousness of God through Christ. You can be forgiven. And all the guilt you feel, the fear for your future, the fear of the afterlife. You know what? that can all be behind you. Because when you receive His forgiveness, the universe changes. The universe changes. Because you as an eternal being have changed. You're no longer destined to live apart from Him in this life and for eternity, but you have a new destiny. And your destiny is to live in relationship with Him now, filled with His Spirit, a masterpiece that He created to do good here and now, and to live with Him forever. Man, that's a change. But that depends on you, whether or not you want to receive it or not. But He offers it. As many as received Him, He gave the power to become the children of God. That's the internal change God wants to work in us. That's what Jesus symbolized in this act. And so when it says that by believing in Him, you'll have life by the power of His name, this is the point. It's an internal change. All right, let's look at this other part of chapter 2, starting in verse 13. It says, it was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration, so Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple area, he saw merchants selling cattle, sheep, and doves for sacrifices. He also saw dealers at tables exchanging foreign money. Jesus made a whip from some ropes and chased them all out of the temple. He drove out the sheep and the cattle. He scattered the money, changers' coins over the floor, and turned over the tables. Then going over to the people who sold doves, he told them, get these things out of here. Stop turning my Father's house into a marketplace. Well, here's nice Jesus going at it again. Huh? It's not like the Jesus that you see in these movies where he's just kind of starry-eyed. Now, there's some firmness to Jesus here. And this account is the first of two of these events where Jesus comes into the temple. The last one is the last week of his life. He does this. The whole issue of the animals were there for sacrifice, and the law said that you were to bring an unblemished animal for sacrifice. So you could imagine who's going to decide if it's unblemished or not. Well, they had inspectors, sacrifice inspectors. And if your sacrifice didn't pass inspection, you know what you had to do? You had to buy a new sacrifice. And guess where you could go? Right over to the vendors. What do you sense here? A benevolent plan to help people that don't have a sacrifice, right? Oh, heck no, no, no. We're all smarter than that. This was a scam. They were scamming these people. They would take the one that they sold them back. Of course, we'll give you a trade-in value here of your blemished lamb. Well, then they turn around and sell the blemished lamb as an unblemished lamb and make a huge profit on it. You can see why Jesus is agitated by this. The money changers? Well, the Roman coin had a picture of Caesar on it. That wasn't acceptable to pay for the temple tax. It was like a tithe that they would pay. You can't pay it with an image of Caesar on it, so they had to change it for the temple. It was called the Tyrian half shekel. So you'd have to change, and of course there was a markup on that. This so-called currency exchange got them too. And so Jesus comes in and he says, stop turning my Father's house into a marketplace. And it's worse than a marketplace. This is a scam joint, is what they turned the temple into. And that's why Jesus is agitated by it. Well, when he does this, he comes in and he takes this whip and he drives them out. He turns over the tables. And then the response to this we read in verses 17 through 22. It says, then his disciples remembered this prophecy from the scriptures, passion for God's house will consume me. But the Jewish leaders demanded, what are you doing? If God gave you authority to do this, show us a miraculous sign to prove it. All right, Jesus replied, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. What? They exclaimed. It has taken 46 years to build this temple and you can rebuild it in 3 days. But when Jesus said this temple, he meant his own body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered he had said this, and they believed both the scriptures and what Jesus had said. Interesting. So what we see is two markedly different responses to this act. We're going to develop this whole idea of the disciples remembering. What's that mean, and how can that apply? That first of all, it says that they remembered what it was said in Psalm 69, that in the other translations it says, "Zeal for my Father's house will consume me." I think sort of the question here for an interpreter is, what's he mean by consume me? You know, as I've read this before and just reading it, I thought, well, that means he's like psychologically consumed with it, that he just can't get it off of his mind. And as you read it, just in the context here, you could think that's what it means. But no, it doesn't mean that as much as it means something else. And you get it. All you have to do is go back. You look at your footnote. Where's this come from? You go back and read it, and then you can understand what it means. You go back to Psalm 69. In the context, this is a psalm of David as he's sort of lamenting the people that are against him. And he says, "For I endure insults for your sake. Humiliation is written all over my face. Even my own brothers pretend they don't know me. They treat me like a stranger. Passion for your house has consumed me. And the insults of those who insult you have fallen on me." You see what he says? How is he consumed? He's devoured by his passion for his fathers. Devoured what? By God's enemies. That his passion for what is right, his passion to do things the way God called him to do it, those are the things that are going to turn others against him, and they will consume him. And it's exactly what happened when Jesus went into the temple. He cleansed the temple on the week that he was executed, and that in part was the reason that they turned against him and decided, we're going to execute this guy and get him out of the way. Passion for my Father's house will be my undoing, would be a better way to say it. And so the disciples, they remembered that, but the Jewish leaders, what did they demand? Well, they demanded a sign. And Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And again, you see these responses. What the Jewish leaders, they turn to him. This is verse 20. They say, "What? It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you can rebuild it in 3 days?" So they take it in a total literalistic way, don't they? And they can't imagine what he might be talking about. And they think, you know, is this guy crazy or what? It says, but his disciples remembered. And what happens here is they remember, but this is later. Look, it says, "But when Jesus said this temple, he meant his own body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered." Now, isn't that interesting? After he was raised from the dead. Well, why was it that his disciples didn't listen to him say, you know, "And destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up"? Why didn't they turn at that point and say, "This guy is crazy. What is he talking about? I can't understand him. I'm not going to follow him anymore"? But instead, here it is, you know, 3 years later, Jesus has died, he's been crucified, he's resurrected, and now they remember what he meant by this statement. What's up with that? Man, there's an important lesson right there. Because remember I said before, you just don't know God's timing. You don't know the timing that he'll answer your prayers. You don't know how he's going to deal with the situation. You know, his disciples, they didn't understand what he meant right here. And maybe they even went to him. We don't know. They might have gone to him and said, "Hey man, what do you mean by that?" And apparently he said, "You're going to have to wait and find out later. I'll tell you later." You see, this is what is dangerous about following God. It's really dangerous if you feel like you got to be in control. It's really dangerous if you feel like you got to have all the answers now. It's dangerous if you got to feel like you have a sense of knowing the outcome today. It's dangerous following God, because that's not the way he operates, because he's got something better for you. And that is the realization that what he has is good, and that is what he's going to deliver for me. Just like the wine, plenty of it, the best wine, and at just the right time. You see, and so you're going to have many cases when you follow God where you're going to remember, "I remember that. And God, it has been good." Last night, they had this fundraising event for Mercy Med Center, which is a hospital in Cambodia. Our friends, the Benedims, a lot of you know them. They work over there. And Margie Benedim spoke last night at this fundraiser, and she talked about the time when they were considering going to Cambodia as missionaries. What an amazing thing, because here they are. He's a partner in an ER group, which means he's making a lot of money. They had a house up in north of Sunbury, which was kind of their dream house out in the country. And they sensed that God was calling them to Cambodia to be missionaries, to love those people, to serve there. And they had four kids. Two of them were teenagers. It's like, it sounds insane to even consider. Why would anybody do that? And she said she was out mowing her grass in her ranch up here in Sunbury, her dream house. And she's mowing the grass, and the sun is setting, and the trees are glowing in the evening sun. It's fall like this. And she says, God, why would you call me to Cambodia? This place is so beautiful. Why would you call me to Cambodia? And she said, I sensed God saying to me, you haven't seen beauty yet. Man, that struck me. You haven't seen beauty yet. You know, you could hold back. You could stay here. But you'll never experience the beauty that you could by following me. You know, and that's what God's calling us to. That's the disciples, you see, they had a trust that Jesus is God made man. They saw what he did. They saw the way he lived. They heard what he taught. He said, this is God. I want to follow him. I may not have everything figured out right now. I don't even know what he meant when he said, this temple, destroy it and I'll raise it. I don't know what that meant. There's a lot I don't know. When they crucified Jesus, his disciples went and they were afraid. They thought that the whole thing was over, even though he had told them. But then they knew that he had raised from the dead. And that was validation that everything he said was true. And then Jesus came back, and it says he met with them and he opened their minds to the scriptures. And they were the ones, the disciples who he had lived with and taught and guided, they were the ones that took his message to change the world. And here we are today, a couple thousand years later. You see, that's what Jesus had in mind to remember. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered he had said this, and they believed both the scriptures and what Jesus had said. So it wasn't that they hadn't believed before, but this is the way God works in our lives too. He builds faith. It's one layer after another. It's sort of like plywood, you know, it's one layer of wood and it gets stronger as it gets thicker. Okay? That's the way faith is. It builds just like that. And what's the significance of this cleansing of the temple when he said, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up? He's saying, listen, no building can confine God. They looked at God's house was the temple. And all along, the temple was meant to serve as a symbol. This is where God's presence is, where you bring the sacrifice into this place. But throughout the history of Israel, God made it clear that you can't confine him in a place. Even when he originally instituted the sacrificial system, it was in a tabernacle, which was a tent that moved about, and God appeared to them as a cloud or a pillar of fire, and he would move and they would pick up the tabernacle, the tent, and they would relocate it. Why? Because God is not contained in a tent. He's not, you know, a camper in that sense. And he's not contained in a building. Even in, you know, like hundreds of years before this and after a temple had been built in Isaiah 66, he says, who can build a house for me? Heaven is my throne and the earth is my footstool. Who can build a house that can contain me? No one can. And so what Jesus is saying is, listen, you've got first thing wrong is you think that it's an external treatment of the body. You wash your spiritual problems away. No, it's internal. He says the other problem you have is you think you come to the temple and that's where you meet God. He says you can't put God in a box down on the corner. How much has that made its way into the thinking of American Christians? I go to church, right? Well, that's not even what church means. The word church, ecclesia, means the called out ones. It's not a place. It's never meant to be a place or an institution. It is a people of God is the church, not a place. And the fact that we have places of worship is not necessarily wrong, but if it communicates that that's where I have to go to pray, that's where I go to meet God, and I can close the door behind me, and I leave him there, and I just walk off, and I do my life the way I want it. And I think that's what's made its way into the American mind. And some of you may have that feeling here. This is your church. And I go and I get my dose of religion on Sunday morning, and I hear from God there, and I'm moved in some way, and I let that door close behind me, and I leave that parking lot, and I just live my life the way I want to the rest of the time. There's no different than this. You just got a temple mentality. You keep him there. It's safe. That way I can just do what I want to do. But you see what you miss out on, man. You miss out on the loving presence of God leading you to do things that you would never do elsewise. Leading you into what Jesus called the abundant life. Leading you to have real life. Leading you to the life that he intended, that you are his masterpiece created for good works, that you might walk in them. You can't even experience that with the temple mentality of God, because you've left him behind. You think you have. So my appeal to us is to think, this is the foundation Jesus lays for us. And it's really the foundation that we should grasp hold of. And I'll just review it here real quick in summary. The water to wine. It's a great provision. There's plenty of it. It's at the right time and it's good tasting. The symbol, it's not an external treatment. It's not ritualistic. It is an internal change that comes by the power of God's Spirit. And that his strategy, Jesus' strategy for reaching the world is through the few, in personal investment in discipleship. And then in the cleansing of the temple, what do we have? Well, we see Jesus' character and his passion that he stood up for the things of God. And then for his disciples, it's important for us to remember, he's left the building. We can't, Jesus has left the building, baby. And any mentality that I go to church to meet God. Well, maybe you do. Hopefully you're going to meet the presence of God when we come together like this. But that's just the beginning. It's not the end. It's the beginning. It's the motivation. It's just part of what God wants to do in our lives.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.